Funds for the California Report are provided by the California Healthcare Foundation, supporting ideas and innovations to improve healthcare for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org. And URS Corporation, a global engineering and construction firm headquartered in San Francisco, providing engineering, construction, and technical services to public agencies and private companies. urscorp.com.
This is the California Report. I'm Scott Schaefer. Coming up, countdown to tax day. The state's top money man describes why it's not what it used to be.
If you look at the old returns, a lot of times the most common mistakes were people not doing addition and subtraction correctly. They weren't signing their forms. That's different now.
Also, a good law gone bad and why fixing it is easier said than done. Plus, the dark side of frontier justice. A new exhibit explores vigilante lynchings in the Wild West.
Many of these victims were new immigrants. They were the new generation, sort of new arrivals, people that were ending up in precarious situations and not always making the right choices.
It's the California Report. This weekend, in addition to the usual errands, baseball games, and family get-togethers, millions of Californians will be scrambling to file their income taxes. The deadline is midnight Tuesday, and in a minute we'll talk with the man who oversees the state's cash flow, State Controller John Chung. But first, we asked people in the San Francisco Bay Area and Fresno for their thoughts about paying their taxes this year.
Taxes are the price we pay for a civilized society. I've traveled extensively in the world in some low-tax countries, and I wouldn't want to live there.
I feel like the biggest problem is that large corporations get more deductions, and so the small business owners are getting cut out because they actually pay a higher percentage of tax.
I would love to get rid of withholding, because if everybody had to write that big check at the end of the year, everybody would be as upset as I am about it, as opposed to getting it taken out a little bit and you don't see it.
I don't like the idea of mandating those who do well to care for their brother and sister. But the way I feel about it is, because I do well, I want to and I feel compelled to take responsibility to make things better for those who have less.
It's not so much what kind of taxes they're charging, it's really where the tax money's going to. Because if we are getting fortune taken out of our pockets in taxes, but all that fortune is coming right back to us, then it's money well spent.
That was Ian Brillenberg. Also, Pamela Lane Guerin, Bill Volpa, Juliet Skaggs, and Steve Walmer talking about their attitude about paying taxes. Well, if you're lucky enough to get a state income tax refund, the check will be signed by the state controller, John Chung, and he's with us now. Mr. Chung, welcome.
Happy to be with you.
Well, I want to begin by asking you for some big picture numbers. Once all the returns are filed, roughly how many Californians will file personal income tax returns by Tuesday's deadline?
Well, altogether last year we had slightly more than 15.5 million tax returns filed. Actually, to date, we have about 11 million tax returns filed. There's quite the rush during the last few days.
So a lot of procrastinators?
A lot of people who are using the full time available.
And what happens at the state level between now and Tuesday?
Oh, there's a lot of work taking place at the headquarters at the Franchise Tax Board. Obviously, you can just imagine the floods of tax returns coming in. They move through a process very quickly. There are a lot of people at the very last minute who are seeking information, so they're going onto our website or going on the Internet, participating in our chat function, and even calling.
And I imagine, 10, 15 years ago, there were literally piles of mail coming in with certified mail, in many cases, with the tax returns. But that probably doesn't happen so much anymore. There are so many e-filers. Give us a sense of what percentage of people now file digitally over the computer.
Well, it's very massive. It's last year, as I pointed out, 15 million and a half tax returns received by the Franchise Tax Board, and 12.2 million of those were e-filed. This year, 11 million tax returns received, and 9.6 million of those were e-filed. So it has changed, as you pointed out, very dramatically over the past few years.
Just how important are income taxes to California state government? You know, what percentage of the overall budget or our overall revenue comes from income taxes?
It is the largest source of tax revenues for the state. In any given year, it could be anywhere from 49% to 53% of state general fund revenues.
But the income tax does seem to be particularly cyclical, doesn't it? It's, you know, can be vary widely from one year to the next.
Yes, we saw that with the recession. California, during the recession, lost in excess of 1.3 million jobs. Since last year, we've recovered slightly in excess of 350,000 of those jobs. But if people aren't work, they have less income taxes to pay, and it has a downstream impact. If you have less income, you're not going to go out and purchase as much, so you may be paying less sales taxes. If you're not purchasing as much, it has an impact on corporate taxes. So it has an impact all across the tax spectrum.
Just this past week, your office issued kind of an update on the cash status. And if I remember correctly, it seems like our revenues are a little behind where they are in the budget. In other words, they're falling a bit short.
That's accurate. For the month of March, we were $233.5 million short of the governor's projections. That's about 4% below we had expected to be. But April and June are very critical months. So if people are interested, and I would encourage them to watch because it has an impact on their health care programs, their kids' schools, they can go to my website and watch the daily personal income tax tracker for the state.
You have to be kind of a government geek to do that, don't you? Do people actually sit there and check that out?
So, quite a few people do.
And the last question, have you filed your income tax?
I have.
I thought you might have. And so where are you going to be on tax day? What will you be doing?
I am going to answer some phone calls at the Franchise Tax Board in the morning, and then in the afternoon I have to get over to CalPERS and work on some serious retirement and health care security issues for Californians.
All right. Well, thanks for taking time to talk with us today.
Have a great day.
State Controller John Chung. One final thought about taxes. The state just released its list of the top 500 tax delinquents in California. Topping the list of deadbeats, Halsey Miner, co-founder of CNET, and his wife Shannon. They owe the state $10.5 million in back taxes. The good news, that's down from $13 million last year. Sometimes the best of intentions go awry. Call it the law of unintended consequences. Well, that's exactly what happened with a state law hailed as pioneering when it was enacted that many now think was a big mistake. And as Amy Standen reports, changing this law, easier said than done.
The subject of this story, the item at the very heart of this controversy, is admittedly a little hard to get excited about.
All right, what's this?
It's a sofa, a green one, for sale at a furniture store in Berkeley.
Good in my living room. Let's just see.
Arlene Bloom is a chemist and founder of the Green Science Policy Institute, a nonprofit group in Berkeley. She lifts a cushion and reads from a small white tag that's sewn into the fabric.
This article meets the flammability requirements of the California Bureau of Home Furnishings Technical Bulletin 117.
117, TB-117, as it's called, is a state law that was passed in 1975. It says that the foam inside upholstered furniture must be able to resist a flame, like from a cigarette lighter. And there's really only one way to meet this law, with chemicals. Not trace amounts of chemicals, but up to 2 pounds of flame retardant chemicals in each sofa. The problem, say Bloom and others, is that the chemicals don't just stay inside the sofas. They turn up in household dust. They can be detected in human blood and breast milk. Toddlers often have higher levels of the chemicals in their bodies than adults do. Some of these chemicals cause cancer in lab animals. Observational studies of humans suggest connections between the chemicals and infertility, as well as abnormal brain development in kids. And for these reasons, state lawmakers have tried 5 times to change this law here in California. 4 of those attempts came from one lawmaker, State Senator Mark Leno, who represents Marin in San Francisco. But he says every time one factor gets in the way. Money.
It's enormously frustrating.
Leno's last bill, SB 147, had the support of furniture makers, firefighter groups, doctors. All of them wanted the chemicals out of furniture. But the bill was killed in committee by a vote of 7-1. every one of those lawmakers had received campaign contributions from the chemical industry. Leno says whenever one of his flame retardants bills would come up for a vote, first he'd pay a visit to each of the committee members to make his case.
And repeatedly, as I would leave a colleague's office an hour or two before the committee hearing, racing to get to another colleague's office, in the waiting room of the office I'm leaving is a lobbyist for the chemical industry. So they'll have the last word.
Just last month, a state lawmaker, Assemblywoman Holly Mitchell from Los Angeles, introduced and then withdrew her own bill on this topic. A spokesperson said Mitchell decided she was too busy but would pick it up next year. Since 2011, Mitchell has taken $3,500 from the chemical industry. It's hard to find supporters of TB-117, this flame retardant rule we've been talking about, who aren't in some way connected to the very same companies that produce flame retardant chemicals. One of those people is Joe Lang. He's a former tobacco lobbyist in Sacramento, whose clients now include the American Chemistry Council. At a hearing last April, Lang pointed out that many of the most harmful flame retardants, a group called PBDEs, have already been banned. Newer alternatives, he said, are safer than the old ones. He said that over-regulating this industry would squelch innovation.
But if we continue to ban chemicals that are developed before they're used, we won't have any chemicals in use. And you won't be able to create the new jobs that people want to create here in California.
But above all, Lang and others in the industry say that these chemicals and the law that requires them, TB-117, serve one critical purpose. They prevent fires. But others dispute this. Donald Lucas is a scientist at Lawrence Berkeley National Lab. He and his colleagues asked exactly this question. Do flame retardant chemicals prevent fires?
Basically, our conclusions were that we really don't need the flame retardants in the foam in home furnishings, so we don't think the TB-117 standard is very good.
The problem with this rule, he says, is that fires don't start inside the sofa. They start on the surface of the sofa, on the fabric. And the law says nothing about the fabric, just the foam.
Once the fabric catches on fire, the flame that the foam is exposed to is much larger than the flame in the test.
And at that point, there's nothing chemicals can do. It's too late.
The foam is going to burn anyway.
In fact, there are far fewer fires today than there were in the 1970s when TB-117 was written. Fewer smokers, laws requiring smoke detectors and sprinklers have made homes a lot safer. These days, most fires start in the kitchen, not on a sofa. That is one reason that even firefighters have had a change of heart on the subject of flame retardants. Here's Tom O'Connor, a firefighter in San Francisco.
The notion of having flame retardants in the home sounds like a great idea until you realize what those flame retardants are.
Until you realize, he says, how toxic they are. That is, for firefighters. He believes there's an epidemic of cancer among firefighters.
And if these chemicals are one of the causes, then obviously we want them out of the products of combustion once we go into a burning building.
There is one person who could sidestep the legislature and change this law. Tanya Blood. She was appointed just last week as the new chief of the California Bureau of Home Furnishings. It's the same agency that established TB-117 back in 1975. Blood's office didn't answer requests for an interview. For the California Report, I'm Amy Standen.
Lynchings are mostly associated with the Deep South, but it turns out they happened in California, too, in the decades after the Gold Rush. In fact, vigilante lynch mobs hanged more than 300 people here. But that part of the state's history had faded until Southern California art professor Ken Gonzalez Day found a picture. That led to another photograph and another, and now to an exhibit at the Vincent Price Museum of Art in Los Angeles. KPCC's Stephen Cuevas has the story.
Scripps College professor and photographer Ken Gonzalez Day says this project wasn't supposed to be about death.
Originally, I was going to write a book on images of Latinos from 1850 to 1900.
Discussing his work at the opening of the Disappearing Into the Trees exhibit, Gonzalez Day says one of the very first images he found was of a Latino man in his early 20s, alive.
In a corduroy suit, three-piece corduroy suit, leaning on a bearskin rug in downtown Los Angeles.
Then he flipped the picture over, where something was written.
The last man hanged in Los Angeles. And it was at that point I realized that I didn't really understand what that meant.
What it meant for Gonzalez Day was the start of a years-long odyssey across California in search of an untold story about mob justice and the more than 350 victims, most of them Latino, who had vanished from history. Far more than any number ever documented by another institution or historian.
Many of these victims were new immigrants. They were the new generation, sort of new arrivals, people that were ending up in precarious situations and not always making the right choices. So some might go through the legal system, others might be summarily executed or hanged by a mob.
These lynchings were often documented by professional photographers who'd create macabre souvenir postcards for the crowds of onlookers. Gonzales Day tracked down dozens of these images. For the exhibit, some of them are blown up into the size of street murals, plunging the viewer into the scene. In one, a few men pose below the branches of a hanging tree. Some smile. In others, there's a carnival-like setting, couples dressed in three-piece suits and mink stoles. Public hangings were often done at night, just as movie houses and bars were letting out. Not seen are the victims. Gonzales Day purposely removed them.
As a way of highlighting the historical erasure of Latinos from the history of lynching in the United States, and it opens up a metaphorical space in which you could contemplate the act. So you can still see the scene, you can see the jeering crowd, you can see the lynchers pulling on the rope, sort of in pantomime.
That one,
yeah,
too.
Yeah, it's giants. Come in.
Ken Gonzales Day has spent much of the past decade trying to pull the victims and the perpetrators back into view. On this afternoon, he ushers a few dozen visitors through the exhibit.
Wrestling with all of those kinds of stories, I just at some point realized that I had to go. I was reading on a case and I realized it was nearby. And I just said, a car's outside. I'm just going to go get in the car and go look.
And off he'd go, visiting actual lynching sites or as close to it as he could find, from rural outposts in the Sierra foothills to big cities like L.A. and San Jose.
Out into beautiful St. James Park, the whimpering pair was dragged. And on that tree, Thomas Thurman was yanked to his doom in less time than it takes to tell it. Then his body was cut down and burned.
If people know of just one public hanging in California, it's probably that of Tom Thurmond and Jack Holmes, lynched 80 years ago in downtown San Jose after allegedly murdering the son of a prominent businessman. The killings got widespread attention, not only because they happened in a big city, but because Governor James Rolfe defended the mob.
That they were so aroused at the kidnapping and the murdering of this young man that they momentarily forgot themselves and was determined to give notice to the world that kidnapping and the murders which follow it would not be tolerated in this state.
The last documented public lynchings in California happened just over 60 years ago. There are few, if any, markers or memorials of any of these hangings, but Ken Gonzales Day says there are the trees. Disappearing into the trees includes haunting portraits he took of some, using an antique wooden field camera similar to the kind used by photographers of public lynchings.
You can peek a little closer. I'll stay out of the way. And the majority of trees they used was a California native oak tree, which is interesting because when you're looking at all the possible trees in California, California native oaks are not as common. People don't really plant them so much anymore because they take a long time to grow, and they grow very slowly.
Just as it's taken photographer Ken Gonzales Day a long time to unearth the story of California's hanging trees and the many victims who bowed their branches. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
Disappearing into the Trees is on view at the Vincent Price Museum of Art in Los Angeles through April. Jazz artists and writers often use food metaphors to describe music, from drummers mixing the dishes to that trio is cooking. Well, now, The Guest House, a new album by Trio M, takes that relationship between jazz and cuisine to a whole new level. The California Report's jazz critic Andrew Gilbert has this review.
A collective ensemble featuring Berkeley pianist Myra Melford, San Diego bassist Mark Dresser, and New York drummer Matt Wilson, Trio M gathered in Berkeley back in 2010 for a collaboration with jazz enthusiast Paul Canales, then chef for the acclaimed Oakland restaurant Olivetto. In preparation for a grand evening of music and food, the players exchanged musical ideas with the kitchen maestro, who in turn sent them photos of dishes he developed in response to their new tunes. The musicians didn't compose every track on The Guest House as part of the Canales project, but he seems to have fueled the trio's creative communion. The album opens with Melford's title track, which positively vibrates with anticipation and excitement as she alternates a telegraphic right-hand figure with a propulsive three-note left-hand riff reminiscent of Cedar Walton's classic tune, Bolivia. With all three players contributing tunes, Trio M encompasses a wide array of moods and textures. Steeped in the modern jazz continuum and deeply versed in avant-garde strategies, the unit can lock into a gospel groove or explore slippery bitonal harmonies. Wilson, the trio's youngest member, is among jazz's most playful and loose-limbed drummers, a musician who finds constant delight in the music's ebb and flow. Among his three tunes, there's the antic, wide-eyed Don Knotts, a loving tribute to the late comic actor. Dresser, who like Melford is a music professor, contributes the album's most ambitious composition. At 12 minutes, Telemojo opens spooky and atmospheric, then flows into a movement featuring Dresser's gorgeous bow work, inspired directly by Chef Canales. Jazz is rife with disappointing all-star sessions lacking chemistry or a sense of soul-bearing communication. Melford, Dresser, and Wilson are all esteemed bandleaders in their own right, but with everyone contributing original music, their emotional commitment to the project is evident throughout. Like on the group's first album, 2007's Big Picture, the guesthouse bustles with new ideas at every turn. Rather than bogging down, the music flows because Trio M's master improvisers know how to find the right nook for every notion. In the guest house, three cooks in the kitchen sounds just right.
Andrew Gilbert is a San Francisco Bay Area writer who covers jazz and world music. He reviewed The Guest House by Trio M. For years, people with disabilities have turned to technology, including smartphone apps, to help them navigate life. But for folks with impaired vision, the iPhone was of little help, until, that is, voice commands came along. The latest iPhone has the audio assistant known as Siri, and reporter Susan Vallet says the blind and visually impaired are taking advantage of it.
Julian Vargas, who's been legally blind nearly all his life, makes his way down a busy street in Van Nuys in the San Fernando Valley. He's on his way to the supermarket. Vargas heads in to do some shopping.
Let's see. Well, that feels interesting. I wonder what that is.
A few years ago, Vargas would have pulled out a handheld magnifier made for the visually impaired, one of many, often expensive tools he would carry around. But now he pulls out his iPhone, activated by his voice. He feels around the touchscreen. The phone reads the icons out loud. He opens a scanning app.
Barcode read. Dove. Smooth milk chocolate. 9.50 ounces, 9.5 ounce bag. Full stop.
Vargas says the iPhone, which started coming standard with accessibility features in 2009, has been a game changer.
It's making it so that blind people don't necessarily only have to buy blindness-specific products, which are typically more expensive and generally speaking are made available to most by help from the government. But those who don't qualify for that kind of help sort of fall through the cracks.
Other visually impaired people have hired Vargas to teach them how to use the iPhone, to go shopping, get around, even read paper money.
No, nothing to it. You just put it over
$5.
Money.
$5.
$1.
$1. Vargas says visually impaired iPhone newbies often don't realize how accessible the phone is to the blind.
You can almost just feel it. Their eyes widen. You can kind of feel that energy that they suddenly have, like, wow, I can do this. Now I can actually go and do this. Now I can actually participate in that. It gives them more confidence. And also just helps you to feel like you're part of something. You know, for the longest time, as a blind person, there's just certain things that maybe you couldn't participate in as readily. You know, when the iPhone first came out, the first two versions of it were not accessible. So everybody's talking about the iPhone. Oh, this is the latest thing. And we're sitting on the sidelines. We can't do anything with it.
Check this out here.
And it's now about ready to interface. Let me just get it to do that.
At a blind technology conference in Culver City, west of L.A., Brian L. Britton, who's completely blind, shows a visually impaired friend how he connects his Braille Bluetooth keyboard to his iPhone.
And then all I do is press a button on the iPhone and move the joystick a couple times. There's my connect tone, so now we're connected.
Al Britton says the iPhone really opened up the world to him. He said he could always get around using a special GPS device made for the blind, but he says the iPhones made it easier.
For instance, if you're in a cab and you're wondering, is this guy going where he's supposed to be? Well, now I can turn on have my GPS turned on and be tracking where he's going. Not too long ago, I told him 741 North Vermont, where I work at Braille Institute, and then I'm checking my GPS, and I says, hey, buddy, I think you're going south. He couldn't believe it. He says, how do you know? I said, my phone told me.
Essentially offering an extra pair of eyes.
That's why they call it the iPhone, I guess.
Nearby, Dr. Bill Takeshita is the chief of low vision at the Center for the Partially Sighted in L.A. He hopes Apple's iPhone accessibility will push other smartphones to be more accessible.
Because of Apple's innovation to incorporate these features for the blind and people with other types of disabilities, I think this is really changing things, because now the competitors will hopefully include that in their products.
And Takeshita says that could mean more choice and more freedom for the visually impaired. For the California Report, I'm Susan Vallett in Los Angeles.
And that's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio. Our director is Susie Rocho. Seal Muller is our technical producer. We had additional engineering by Howard Gelman. The senior online editor is Gabriel Cohen, with help from David Marks. Our interns are Andres Barraza and Liz Reed. The producer is Victoria Maleone. Our senior producer is Ingrid Becker. The executive producer is Raul Ramirez. I'm Scott Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, with nomination information about the 2013 Leadership Awards at www.irvine.org. Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information at chevron.com. And the California Endowment, building healthy communities because that's where health happens. More information at calendow.org.